Well, so this morning we are starting a new series going through some important questions that you, no doubt, occasionally ask, and maybe you are even asked. And these will be questions that, like for example, how do we know our Bible is true? Why does God allow evil? Can we trust our translations? What is God saying in His Word? These are all very important questions, but they really all come back to one central question, one central idea, and that question is this. We're going to talk about it this morning. The question is, does God exist? Now, I don't want to assume that if you're in this room that you automatically have that question checked off. And like you just know that you know that you know that God exists and you never have any wavering moment of doubt. In fact, I'm just going to assume that you are like everyone else in the world and that living here in this place, occasionally you wrestle with doubt. And if that's not you, if you can't remember the last time you wrestled with doubt, I promise you, you come in contact with people every single day who do. And they need to know the answer to this critical, central question about the existence of God. This past weekend, Kim and I drove down to South Carolina to meet up with our son and daughter-in-law and grandchildren who are moving up this way, and we were preparing them for the move and kind of hanging out, and we took a day and went down to the beach. That's where this tan comes from that you see up here. If you don't see it, you should have seen me before. It was even more pasty. And so we were out there for a couple of hours. And every time I go to the beach, my mind is drawn back to a time not too many years ago when Kim and I were out by ourselves and we were at a beach. And I was sitting there you know how you do it. It was one of those perfect days. The weather was just right. Temperature was good. Skies were clear. The waves were just clapping. And it was just, man, it was gorgeous. And I remember thinking to myself, God, you did such an amazing job on this. Just hand clap for you, man. This is incredible. What a beautiful creation here. That declares your handiwork. And I acknowledge that. And then I felt like God sort of leaned down and sort of asked me, so you like that? You appreciate the clapping of the waves and the spray that's blowing in and the sun and the clouds in the sky? And I'm like, yeah, it's incredible. And it's almost like I think he said to me, that's great, but it's not for you. And then my mind was drawn to this passage in Psalm 119, which tells us what it's all about, why creation is doing what it does. Why our breath is taken at the lightning strike and the sunny day alike. Why, if you're in the middle of the woods and you're hearing the animals chirp in the background, or if you're out on a beach and simply taking in the endless scene of the horizon, your breath is just kind of taken by what is so beautiful. Listen to how the psalmist puts this in Psalm 119:1. He says, the heavens declare your glory, the glory of God, and the skies above proclaim his handiwork. Day to day pour out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber, and like a strong man runs into the course of with joy. He's comparing it to this huge wedding scene and the breathtaking celebration. Its rising is from the end of the heavens, and its circuit to the end of them. And there is nothing hidden from its heat. What's he doing here? He is saying what is repeated throughout Scripture a number of times, and that is simply this, that creation exists for the purpose of glorifying God. That it as the mountains rise, the peaks lift up their hands in worship. As the waves come crashing in on the shores, they are clapping to the rhythm of praise for the God that you and I serve. And so as I was laying there that day, taking it all in, and God showed me what he probably showed to you, and that's that this creation exists for his worship, I felt at that moment like an outsider. I'm simply someone who's eavesdropping on a perpetual worship service that's directed to the glory of God. Man, that gripped me at that moment when I realized that all of creation is like a machine that is built to give God glory, even in the dark days, the difficult days, the challenging days, the times that creation seems to fight back against us. In the middle of all of that rises the glory that is due only to God. And so I thought to myself as I'm wrestling with this passage and meditating on it, I thought, how much more evidence could a person ask for that God exists? The heavens declare his handiwork. And the deeper we go into our understanding of the universe where we live, the more we understand about its vastness in the cosmos, or the more we understand about the detail of its quantum foundation, the more you and I just are exposed to the truth of who God is. And so, for me, I thought briefly, the proof of God is undeniable. Now, the only problem with that is that there are people who deny it. There are those who are incredibly intelligent individuals who have looked at the evidence that you and I see, and it provokes us to worship, and for them, it provokes them to awe of a godless creation. I grappled with this. I thought, how is this the case that the same creation could turn some hearts to worship and yet darken other hearts? And then it dawned on me as I meditated on this is that there really is no way to prove the existence of God beyond all doubt. I'm just watching to see if anyone stands up to leave at this moment. But it's true, and we're going to talk about that today, and I want to show you that is the case, why it is, what God's doing about it, and why we respond the way that we do. As I was thinking about how to make this point, I thought about the law, and I briefly thought about trying to explain how evidence and proof works in the court of law, and then it dawned on me that we happen to have in this room a lawyer. I know this because I've got a huge list of lawyer jokes that I can't tell. Because Nick Lauer is here, and so I'm going to ask Nick, if you will, to come up and join us for a moment. And Nick is going to explain to us about proof and how it works. Come on up. You're okay. And how much proof do you need? Because I think, Nick, I'm guessing if the burden of proof for you was beyond all doubt, your job would be a whole lot more difficult, wouldn't it?
And I have lawyer jokes that I can say, if you want them.
But can you?
I can. All right. You know what? All right. I won't do that, though. Yeah, there's two main standards. Pastor asked me to kind of lay out the standards of proof in law. And in civil law, the main standard is preponderance of the evidence, which is basically, what story do you believe more? The illustration I like to use for this one's the Solomon, when two mothers come before him, both claiming the same baby. And he goes, well, I've got an idea. Give me my sword, we'll cut the baby in half and give you each half of them. And based off of his knowledge of human nature, their reactions dictated who the real mother was. One said, don't hurt the baby. One said, that sounds like a great idea. And the mother that said, that sounds like a great idea, no human mother would react that way. And so he's like, I believe the other mother's story more than hers. So in law, we call it preponderance of the evidence is 50% plus a feather. And he's like, their reactions showed me who the real mother was. On the criminal law side, I'll step a little more over here this way. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. And I just brought the jury instruction for you. Because some you'll watch on TV defense attorneys say, like, beyond a shadow of a doubt, beyond, you know, beyond all doubts, what Pastor said. And that drives me nuts because that's not the standard anywhere. In Virginia, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. And the Commonwealth, you know, has to prove each element beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury instruction says this does not require proof beyond all possible doubt, nor is the Commonwealth required to prove every conceivable circumstance of innocence. However, suspicion or probability of guilt is not enough for a conviction. A reasonable doubt is a doubt based on your sound judgment after a full and impartial consideration of all the evidence. And I like to use a family-friendly church illustration for that, of the case of the missing cookies. So if you haven't got kids and you make them, you know, a dozen cookies for an event the next day, you wake up and there's only 10 cookies in that cookie jar, you got to figure out who did it. Well, there's two forms of evidence. You got direct evidence and you got circumstantial. Direct is the dutiful daughter that is doing her homework at 5 o'clock in the morning and she sees her other sibling come down and eat the two cookies and rats her sibling out. And you've got direct evidence of an eyewitness who says, I saw my little brother take the cookies. But you don't always have a dutiful, you know, elderly, older daughter doing her homework at 5 o'clock in the morning. So sometimes you have to rely on circumstantial evidence. Where you notice two cookies are missing, you go to that younger child and you go, interesting. I see a cookie crumb on the side of your chin. I see some chocolate on your lip. Open your mouth. Your breath smells like cookies. Now, no one saw him take the cookies. You don't have a direct eyewitness saying that he saw the cookies. But based off of the evidence of the crumb, the chocolate, you know who took the cookies. Now, he can be a defense attorney and be a parent who I love with all my heart and would never lie to. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, I could have walked over to the 7-Eleven and bought cookies, or I got cookies stashed under my bed from two Christmases ago. But in your sound judgment, you're going to be like, son, who I love with all my heart, there's two cookies missing, and there's evidence that you ate cookies. So in my sound judgment, I know what reasonably happened here, and beyond a reasonable doubt, those cookies are the ones that are on your chin and chocolate on your lip and the ones that are missing. So I may have taken too long with this illustration, but Pastor wanted me to lay out the two forms of proof. And I do get annoyed when defense attorneys say beyond a shadow of a doubt because that is, I don't know where that came from, but it has been stated a lot in movies and shows.
Yeah, that's perfect, Nick. Thank you so very much. Would you all thank Nick for giving us that explanation? Yeah, right. I mean, the kid could have been framed. Aliens could have done it. I mean, anything could have happened. You can always find an excuse to disbelieve. Now, that raises some questions for me because I live in a world like you where I serve a God who can do anything, which means he could have established this system that you and I live in such a way so that there's no room for disbelief at all. There's just the way things work is you can prove it and there's just no explanation around it. But he didn't do that. I mean, even if, for example, you were to wake up tomorrow morning and there were to be a glowing light in heaven that said in every conceivable language, God is real. Do you think 7 billion people would suddenly begin to genuinely believe in God? No. I mean, there's always a reason. It could have been put up there by aliens. It could have been put up there by Republicans. It could have been put up there by Elon Musk. I mean, we just don't know, right, who put it up. And so there's always this little bitty sliver of place where we have to have faith. Now, here's what I want to do. I want to spend just a few minutes wrestling with two questions And then I want to talk about how you and I should respond to these two questions. Number one, the first question is, why did God do it this way? Why did God make disbelief even an option? And the second question we're going to deal with is, why do you and I make disbelief our choice? Why do we do it? What causes us to disbelieve? This is very important because it changes not only how we approach the times of doubt in our own heart, but it also changes how we approach doubt with others. Because this isn't an intellectual issue, ladies and gentlemen. Knowledge is important. The arguments we make are essential to putting forth a reasonable argument for the reason that we believe. But at the end of the day, it requires so much more. So let's look at this together. Why did God make disbelief even an option? Well, this goes back to the very beginning of the garden. See, at the very beginning of the garden of creation, God took Adam and Eve and put them into a perfect environment. Everything was exactly as you and I would have wanted it, except for one very little thing. It was the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And there God placed this option, this opportunity for disbelief, this opportunity to choose something other than Him, and then said to them, you are allowed to eat of every tree in the garden. I don't know how many trees were there, but I'm thinking there were 1,000. And so they could eat from 99.99% of the trees that were in the garden, but this one tree that was there, this is the one thing that God said, don't do this. Now, one of the arguments against the existence of God, or at least the God of Christianity, is why would God even put the tree there to begin with? But I'm going to tell you, as I have shared with you before, that the tree was essential to the plan of God. It had to be there. Because God was not interested in simply creating these robots, these automatons, these AI-empowered programmed beings that He could hang out with. God wanted a genuine relationship. Well, We've talked about this before. You know, if you watch the news very often, you'll see articles and programs that are talking about artificial intelligence and its impact on our future. And one of the questions that keeps coming up is, will artificial intelligence at some point be able to replace the relationships that we have with other people? And in fact, some are already pursuing these kinds of connections, where they're chatting with bots and getting their relationships filled and their desire and need for communication filled from this AI that's been programmed. And if you stop and think about that for a moment, that is just incredibly weird. And in fact, we would kind of think to ourselves that a person who finds their emotional attachment to a programmed piece of software is probably someone who should be talking to a counselor, because that doesn't feel natural for us, to us. Well, it's the same thing for God. If God had created humans who did not have choice, it would be essentially like Him going in and programming us or having someone else program us. But He didn't want that. He wanted relationship, and relationship requires choice. It tells you a lot about the kind of God that we serve. It explains why, by the way, whenever Eve's teeth first broke through the skin of that fruit, and then Adam joined her, it explains why God didn't look down and just hit the Command Z key on His keyboard. Y'all know what the Command Z key is? Yeah, it's the undo button. It's pretty helpful for those of us who make mistakes on the regular. God, he could have done that. He could have just said, well, that didn't work out very well. Let's not do the tree next time. Command Z and everything's gone and He just starts over. He easily could have done that. But He did not do it. What did He do instead? He came down to the garden. He walked through the garden. And then He spoke. Adam, Eve, where are you? That tells you a great deal about what God is really seeking in this. And so for this reason, disbelief becomes necessary for you and I. Because I know some of you are sitting there perhaps thinking to yourself, okay, that's good for Adam and Eve. They made a choice, but I'm not making the choice. Like, I'm already here and I'm doing this thing because of what they did. And so I don't get a choice. And the truth is, you do. The only difference is that we're not given the option of two trees, we're given the option of two truths. The truth of there is a God that is declared by creation and then described in detail in His Word. That's one truth. And the other truth is this is just a random set of circumstances that occurred over billions of years, and because it occurred over billions of years, given enough time, we could evolve into this thing that we see here now. Now, I'm just going to tell you, we're going to talk in coming weeks about why that doesn't work, and why it is now that while biologists and those who come out of the field of biology are still holding to an agnostic or an atheistic view, why it is that many in academia, cosmologist and a physicist are wide open to the idea that there is a God out there. But He has to be chosen. And He has to be chosen because God is interested not in your compliance, He's interested in you. That is a significant type of God from the kind of God that is worshiped worldwide, whose declaration to humanity is, here's a list of things that you're going to do. You're going to be a good neighbor. And if you're not a good neighbor, I'm going to take you out of the neighborhood, period. That's not the kind of God that Christianity serves. Christianity is the kind of God who doesn't treat you as a neighbor, where God looks across the yard and says, you better do something about that grass or I'm going to call the HOA. We serve the kind of God who invited us into His house. And we live with Him and He takes care of the lawn. It's significantly different. That's why God did it. But that brings us to the next question. Why do we choose disbelief? So we talked about why God created disbelief as an option. What is it about us that causes you and I to choose disbelief? I spent a few minutes earlier this week looking back through Malcolm Gladwell's Blink. I don't typically like quoting Malcolm Gladwell because he gets quoted by preachers a lot, and some of his stuff is, you know, anyways. But he makes a real good point in Blink. He talks about how for a period of time, tennis players like Andrew Agassiz, yes, there you go, thank you so much. I'm going to butcher his name. Famous tennis pros, let's just say that instead. For many years, when they were describing what they were doing on the court, they would say, it's real simple. You just roll your racket across the ball. The idea being is that you just slightly roll your wrist. And so tennis coaches all over the world began to coach this technique where as you swung at the tennis ball, you would slightly roll your wrist to hit it with just a certain angle to give it an additional speed and spin. And that's how they described it. Now, here's the problem with their description of what they were doing. A tennis ball is struck by a pro at 140 miles an hour. That is fast. That means it crosses the tennis court in 0.38 seconds from corner to corner. And sometimes they're not hitting the ball from corner to corner. And so sometimes the ball crosses less than 0.38 seconds. Now that's quick, ladies and gentlemen. But here's what makes that whole idea worth a PhD dissertation and apparently a book, is that the human eye passes signal to the brain. That signal takes distance. It takes time to get light, to get a photon of light from here, from your eye to your brain. It takes about a tenth to two-tenths of a second. And then it takes time to get an electrical signal from your brain down to your spinal cord and out to your hand or, you know, to your legs or to your body to say duck or slant or lean or reach. It takes another 0.2 seconds. And so what is being said here is that to even begin to move in the direction of the ball, it takes 0.4 seconds. It takes nearly half a second before you can begin moving on the ball. Now, why is that significant? Well, what has been pointed out by Gladwell, as well as Daniel Kahneman and some other people, this is very, very interesting, is that these individuals, by the way, just listen. If I lost you with that, come back in, because here's the point. These individuals who describe what they're doing with the ball have no idea what they're doing with the ball. It's reactionary. They're not thinking anything. They don't have time to think anything. It's all happening subconsciously, and the way Kahneman puts this, he says that decisions come first, and then later, say during the interview, or whenever you're coaching another tennis player, you're explaining what you think you did based on how you remember it. In other words, we make decisions and then later justify the decisions that we've made. Now, does that apply to other aspects of life? Well, Malcolm Gladwell and Daniel Kahneman would argue that it does, that this is how you and I make decisions all the time, that we respond based on something inside of us. Habit, heart, just reaction, right? Biological instinct, but there's something down inside of us that causes us to move, and when we move, later we come back by and say, oh, well, that's because of this. I would argue to you, and I think their evidence is pretty clear, that we philosophically do this as well, that people make choices because of what they want to do. In other words, why do you and I make the decisions that we do? We do so because we prefer deep down inside darkness rather than light. Now, this becomes very clear whenever you read some of the writings from the four horsemen of atheism, you know, the Hitchens, the Sam Harris's, and even Dawkins to an extent. Whenever you're reading their writing, they will sometimes, you can catch them saying things like, I don't want to respond. I don't want to be under the thumb. I don't want to be held accountable to this God, to a being. I want to be in control of myself. And so they're not approaching this from a neutral stance. They've made their decision. They have swung, told the world that the secret is to roll your wrist just a little bit, but whenever you go back and you look at it, you realize that's not what they did at all. Instead, what they did is they made a choice based on what they wanted to do, what was inside of them. And the Bible picks up on this very clearly. Jesus says in John chapter 3, verse 19, directly after that famous passage that we see on billboards and, you know, face paint, John 3:16, God loved the world so much that he gave his only son, that whosoever should believe in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. In the very next verse, Jesus says, well, he says the truth is that anyone who has not believed is condemned already. Now, you know what that means. That means that everyone who is born disbelieving. This is how you start. Christianity is not you coming to a fork in a road and deciding left or right. Christianity is not you coming to a stop sign and deciding, do I want to go to heaven or hell? No, no, you and I are on our way to hell. And Jesus is a rescue helicopter that's pulling us up off of that road and taking us somewhere else. That's the truth about Christianity. We were condemned already. Then Jesus continues. Look at what he says in verse number 19, because he wants to explain this to everyone. Because, you know, most people don't realize, like, we don't want to think that we're bad people. I mean, we might think we're not good people, but we're better people than other people. which makes us not bad people. And Jesus comes in and he says, this is the judgment for everybody. Because everyone is born condemned, and this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people loved the darkness rather than the light. That's what's going on. That's why we choose evil. See, the truth is, we may go and examine the evidence that we want to hear. Not open up books by Craig Bryan Larson or evidence that demands a verdict or even to pause and to consider. We just open up the things that confirm our bias and pretend like we're not being driven by something deep and dark down inside of us. Jesus says it's darkness. He says they do this because their works are evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light. This is the truth. We hate the light and does not come into the light lest his works be that should be exposed. Paul put it this way later in Romans, very familiar passage of Scripture when discussing this topic. He says, for although they knew God, there's something down inside of them, Paul would argue, and over the next 4 weeks, we're going to be arguing, there's something down inside of them that makes God just necessary, just ever so obvious. So you and I seem to think that we, as a species, did not wrestle with this question until Darwin wrote his little book. That's not true at all. I'm going to show you some writings from Epictetus as well as Aristotle that prove that they were wrestling with this question thousands of years ago. And Paul comes in and he acknowledges what many of them were saying is that there's a motivation behind what you choose. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. They didn't give glory to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. And exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling the mortal men and birds and animals and creeping things, he says. What's he saying there? He's saying that people make their choices and they carve their idols, whatever they are, based on what they really want to worship. This is why we do what we do. God does what he did. God made disbelief an option, a choice, because he wanted relationships. And he gives us a choice. He gave Adam and Eve a choice. And today he gives you and I a choice too. We make that choice based on what we want to do. Do we want to be, are we hearing the whispers of the enemy, the echo from the garden that you can be your own God, that you can be your own person, that you can do your own thing? Or do we believe the truth? That there's someone out there whose voice is vibrating everything and animating everything that we see now. The funny thing is, for me anyways, is that while you can go back to before the time of Christ and see that they wrestled with these questions, they're making the same kind of arguments that we're going to be making in the coming weeks. The only difference is we know so much more than they know. I mean, when Aristotle argued that anything in motion was set into motion by a first cause, by a first principle, he observed the bodies in the sky and their motions, but he could not imagine their complexity, nor the number of them that were out there, or the incredible mathematics that drives everything. But we do. Has that made us more likely to believe, to choose to believe in God? It hasn't. Why is it not? It's because we choose. We choose. And that brings us to a very important third question, and we're almost done. The third question is, what should we do about it? God has given us a choice. It's a necessary choice because he wants relationships and not just rigorous rules or religion. We make our choice. Our choice is influenced, right, by our own bias and our sinfulness. And so many around us, and sometimes even we ourselves, choose darkness rather than light. What do we do about that? I have two suggestions here, and they're coupled together because they're both, well, one leads to the other. Number one, acknowledge the light. Number two, accept the relationship. Acknowledge the light. Just consider whether or not these things are true. Just hear. Listen. Give truth its fair hearing. For those of you maybe who believe and yet you have neighbors or loved ones that you're trying to reach, family members who have willingly bought into this lie that there is no God and that all that is in nature is all that there is, this is what you do for them. We don't try to convince them with arguments. The arguments aren't going to win. We just want them to be open to the light. Will you consider? I mean, just for a moment, just consider the possibility that you might be wrong and that there might be something else out there. And you would be surprised in darkness, in the pitch black darkness, how just a little bit of light will illuminate the whole space. This is exactly what Jesus was talking about in Luke chapter 8, verse 17. Great passage of scripture. Let me just remind you real quickly, Jesus has been talking about the power of the seed, which represents the word of God, to flourish. And so he tells this story about a gardener who goes out and he plants the seed everywhere. Like he just takes it out of his bag and he just flings it across the yard. And if it lands on good soil, it grows. If it lands on hard soil, it doesn't. If it lands on the sidewalk, then it doesn't grow either. But he's just throwing it everywhere. And wherever the seed could find just a little bit of root, it would spring up. Now afterwards, the disciples come back to Jesus and they said, listen, we were actually here for theology 101, not agriculture 101. You're going to explain to us how one thing leads to the other. And Jesus says, okay, here's, and Jesus explains it to them. And he explains it to them using a couple of other metaphors we won't talk about, but at the end of it, he says this. He says, for there's nothing hidden that will not be made manifest, nor is anything in secret that will not be known and come to light. Now, how does that explain this metaphor about the seed? Well, just before this verse, there's a very popular passage of Scripture that you will remember if you grew up in church. It's a verse about taking a light and hiding it under a bushel. No, thank you. For those of you who know the song, this is a little light of mine, right? Yeah, hide it under a bushel. No, right? This is where we get it from. Jesus says no one's going to light a candle and then hide it under a bushel or a basket or put it under a bed. I'm not going to do that. You might think what Jesus is saying is that, well, it just wouldn't make sense to do that. Why would anybody go through the trouble of lighting a candle or a lamp and then hide it under a bushel? And you're partly true. But there's a little nuanced difference that's very important whenever you connect it to this verse, and it's this. It's that if the reason it's so foolish is because if you really wanted to make the light go away, you wouldn't try to hide it. You would turn the light off because you can't hide light. Give it a try. Get your best flashlight, your best LED. Go and get one of your kids' little buckets or baskets or, you know, a little basket from the laundry room and take it and hide it in the middle of the night. Take it and hide it under that basket. And what you're going to see is little slivers of light bursting through out of the cracks, especially in this culture, because they didn't have, you know, perfectly symmetrical, smooth, everything holds water kind of buckets. Everything had a little crack to it, and just the slightest little crack or sliver, that light would shine through. You see, that's the power of the truth of the Word of God. I mean, I have to believe that, because the one thing I know for sure is I can't convince anybody of anything. I've got a list of things that I've tried to convince my kids of. Little things, like I'm always right. No matter how I try, there's no argument, right? They don't believe me. I mean, We need something more. We need something more potent, something more powerful. And God has given us something more potent and something more powerful. And that is the light of His truth. Can I just ask you for a moment, have you heard it? Have you seen it? Are you willing to look at it? Are you willing to listen to it? Some of you here in this room, I mean, we all wrestle with doubt at times, but some of us, like, we wrestle with doubt so much that we kind of lean that way. And what that inevitably leads to is we begin to hedge our bets in this world. Yeah, I'm going to go to church just in case. But I'm going to keep this for me because I just want to make sure if I come to the end of life and there's nothing else out there, I just don't want to have wasted my life. Or you're like, you know, I'm going to give, but I'm only going to give so much. I'm only going to do so much because I think there might be a God out there, but I'm not real sure. And so I'm going to hedge and I'm going to give this part just to make sure, but I'm going to keep a lot of this for myself, this time for myself, just in case, because I don't want to get to the end of my life and find out I wasted it because there's nothing else after this. Listen, that's not the kind of way that you live a life that flourishes and that celebrates meaning and joy. We live that life by believing it. Can I ask you, do you believe it? Do you stop and consider and, dare I say, maybe rather than streaming, you know, police pursuit videos online, perhaps pull up something by John Lennox or, you know, an apologist who's willing to remind us and reassure us God is real. Others of you, maybe like you've just totally settled in your mind that this is just, it's all a game. It's not real. Science has made religion unnecessary. You're going to see in the coming weeks that that's not true by a long shot. And we're seeing that in our culture as this rising tide of people who are emerging up out of this social experiment that we've tried in this country where everything was about the individual and you make your own choices. And I mean, that has led exactly where many 20 years ago said it would lead. It's not going to provide the joy and the happiness and the fulfillment that you think you're going to find. And so as people are emerging out of that, they're looking for something else. And I happen to know what is the thing that reveals to them the hope that they desperately need. And it comes from believing this thing first. There is a God. He's spoken in His Word. And He's told us the truth, that you and I cannot be our own God. We must depend on Him, which is why He sent His Son the way that He did, so that you and I cannot rely on any of our works, our good thoughts, our good actions. All of that gets flushed with the filthy rags. Everything instead is thrown on the cross, and Jesus bears it all. What joy is there in that, that you and I, we know not just that there is a God, but we know His name. And He came from heaven to earth to live with us. If for no other reason, just so that you and I can know for certain that He's not simply after making us less annoying. He wants a relationship with us. He wants to be with us.